Welcome to the Long Thread Podcast about spinning, stitching, and weaving by hand. The podcast is presented by Long Thread Media, publishers of Handwoven, Piecework, Spinoff, and Little Looms magazines. Find us online at longthreadmedia.com. This episode is sponsored by Trainway Silks. You'll find the largest variety of silk spinning fibers, silk yarn, and silk threads and ribbons at trainwaysilks.com. Choose from a rainbow of hand-dyed colors. Love natural? Their array of wild silk and silk blends provide choices beyond white. Trainway Silks, where superior quality and customer service are guaranteed. I'm your host, Long Thread Media co-founder Anne Merrow. Karen Selk was a spinner and weaver when an encounter with a skein of silk changed the course of her life. She found herself chasing silk all over the globe. She's written a new book about her experience called In Search of Wild Silk, which will be released in fall 2022. Karen and her husband Terry founded and operated Trainway Silks for 34 years until selling it to current owner Susan Dubois in 2011. So Karen, what do you love so much about silk?
Oh my gosh, what a question, Anne. I guess just about everything. I first fell in love with silk when I wove a scarf. And from there, it was like, wow, I think this is what I want to work with. And I want to understand it inside out, not just its properties, but how it comes to be, how it's raised, everything about it. So it started with weaving a scarf, and then it's just been everything silk ever since.
When you say weaving a scarf, was it what we think of as, air quotes, ordinary Bombyx silk?
No, the very first scarf I wove, that's why I wanted to understand so much about it. The very first scarf I wove, I got some Noil silk from Robin and Russ at a conference years ago. This was in the 70s, before we knew what some of those words meant, real silk, Bombyx silk, you know, all those different terms for silk. And I bought it because it said silk and it wasn't very shiny. And I thought, well, you know, maybe when I get it woven, it'll be shinier. When I wove it, it wasn't shinier. Then I thought, well, if I wash it, maybe it'll be shinier. And it wasn't shinier. So it never did get to be shiny. And I went back and I looked at the cone. And I didn't see the word Noil or raw or anything there, but that's what started the journey. I thought, okay, there's a lot more to this fiber than I ever knew there was. So then started the research. And in those days, we didn't have many textile books at all. So I had to go and look through home ec books and learn about silk and all the different types of silk that there were and how we got all the different yarns that there are. The days of the internet now are absolutely fabulous, but research in the 70s was quite different.
So the funny thing is that that's not actually a very auspicious beginning. You started off with something thinking, oh, it will be shiny, and it never was shiny. And yet it led you down this road.
Yep. I never gave up because I had seen beautiful shiny cloth. And of course, I thought it must be something that I had done until I started my research and then realized how many different qualities of silk there were and that the way that we unravel the cocoon brings all these different qualities of silk our way.
There's how you unravel the cocoon, but then there's also the different kinds of silk that are available, the different silkworms and cocoons. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I must say that the favorite are the wild silks. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The white silk is beautiful and shiny and smooth, and it's lovely to work with. And that's what most of us have the opportunity to work with. But I love the wildness of the wild silk. I love the texture. I love the color. I love the fact that the wild silkworms themselves do not want to be domesticated and do not want to live indoors. They're a bit rebellious. And somehow that whole character of the silkworms just really speaks to me. So there's three different types of wild silk that are produced in the world. Tussa, or Tussar, as it's known in India, and that many of us are familiar with. It's kind of a beige color. Muga, which a lot of people are not familiar with, is grown only in Assam. Now, that's a state in India. And the reason it's only grown there is because the Brahmaputra River flows through that country and creates an ecosystem that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So the food trees that the Muga silkworms eat from are grown only there. The Muga silk is a beautiful golden color. It almost looks like the gold thread that I have. And then the third type of wild silk is called eerie. And all the silkworms look totally different. And the eerie, that silk is white, and it's not shiny like the other silks are. It has more of a cotton look and feel to it, but with just a little bit of a sheen. And eerie right now is gaining all kinds of popularity in the fashion world for that specific reason. It has the same qualities of other silk. It's warm in the winter and cool in the summer, but yet it doesn't have the shine. So you can have a shirt out of eerie silk and feel absolutely wonderful in your skin. But at the same time, it doesn't look like you're ready to go out for a fancy dinner. So those three silks I have a real strong affinity for. And I started saying that eerie silk is becoming quite popular in the fashion world for the reason that it isn't shiny. And the majority of eerie silk is also raised in Assam, that state in India. And it's making a real difference to the people that live there financially. The government and NGOs and all kinds of people are involved to make the rearing of the silkworms not only sustainable, but give them much better income. And so that's a real plus and something that I have enjoyed seeing in my travels.
I've also seen red eerie. Is that from the same place? Is it just a question of diet?
Good question. No, it's not a question of diet. It's just a part of their biological makeup. And it's very interesting in the same area when we travel, we can go to one village and one village raises all kinds of white eerie. And then the next village raises all kinds of red eerie. And I talked to one of the rearers about that and he said, we never know. We try both. And sometimes we raise the red ones better and sometimes the white ones. And they both eat exactly the same food plants and they're raised exactly the same way. So I guess the little genetic difference might be the difference between a red delicious and a yellow delicious apple. So it's just a small genetic difference, but everything else about it is just the same. Well, you have done your homework knowing about red eerie. Not many people do.
Well, I was talking with Susan Dubois, who's current owner of Treenway, and she was recently giving a presentation about those very kinds of silk, the Tusa Muga eerie, and she also mentioned red eerie. And she talked about something that I've only heard of recently called peduncle or peduncle silk. And when I looked into it, the only information I found was a web post that you had written many years ago.
Ah, do you want to talk about the peduncle? Because it is very fascinating.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
There are two types of tussa caterpillars. Tussa caterpillars that are temperate and grow in temperate regions, and tropical tussa caterpillars that grow in tropical areas. And it's only the tropical tussa that have the peduncle. And this is just a fascinating thing that the silkworms do. When they're ready to start spinning their cocoon, they strip off a thin piece of bark and they extrude the very first part of their silk and they take it, what they're extruding, that silk, and they wrap it around the thin piece of bark and then wrap that around a twig so it makes almost a ring and it looks like a stem hanging from a branch. And they hang from that and wrap a little leaf around themselves, and that's how they start spinning their cocoon. So when the cocoon is spun, the rearers don't cut the peduncles off the cocoons because it's also valuable. They cut the branches from the trees with their trimmers or secateurs and then slide the cocoons off. And the peduncles used to be used for things like stuffing mattresses and things like that because they're really, really hard because they've got that bark in them. But now They're using very simple carding equipment for carding cotton, and they're degumming and beading and all of these things to soften it up, and then using the cotton carding equipment to make a roving and then spinning a yarn with the peduncle, which is a beautiful dark gray color, and it makes a fabulous cloth. Peduncle means stem. In fact, the thing that connects our vertebrae up into our head is called a peduncle. So it's stem. It means stem.
You mentioned going to the villages and meeting people who are raising these different kinds of silk. How did you start to do that? What was your first, I think I'm going to travel around to the other side of the world and see where they are growing worms?
No. Not at all. I guess it started with the whole idea of wanting to know everything I could know about silk. And of course, that doesn't happen in North America. So I started traveling in China and Thailand because I wanted to see what people like you and I were doing on their looms and how they were working with silk and how they got silk fiber out of the cocoons. And then after that, I did a lot of traveling with Michelle Wiplinger, and we were always going to write a book together, and that didn't happen. And we decided to research in India next. And that was after I had started my research about Noyal and learning more about silk, et cetera, et cetera. And I did know that there was Tussa, and I did know that there was Muga, and I did know that there was Eri. And when we got into India, we kept asking questions all over the place because Michelle wanted to learn about dyes. I wanted to learn about these wild silks. And finally, we started getting some answers where we needed to go to see the rearers and also to see the spinners and the reelers. And that was the beginning. At first, I just wanted to know about the silk, and I just wanted to know how it was unraveled from the cocoon. But then as I started to travel, I saw that it really starts with the people who work with the silkworms, the rearers who raise the silkworms, and then the spinners and the reelers who unravel it. So there's a whole wonderful personality or person connection, human connection behind the fiber that we work with. And in the end, that is what really fascinated me and took me back again and again and again. Not only that, it's amazing how long it takes to totally understand a process, especially if it's in another country, because India has 22 states and 22 languages with 720 dialects. And so a village will have its very own dialect. So when we travel, sometimes we're getting information through three translators, and talk about getting lost in translation. That happens all the time. So it was many trips through many seasons, because sometimes you get the caterpillars when they're babies. Sometimes you get to see the caterpillars when they're mature. Sometimes you get to see them when they're a moth, but never do you get to see that all at once. And never do you get to see that all at once for all three varieties. So it just meant, you know, once I got totally hooked with the people and their lifestyle and the amazing tender care that they give these caterpillars, because it's totally different than the white Bombex caterpillars. They're raised indoors. They're really pampered. But the wild silks, they're called wild silks because they refuse all of that pampering. They live out in the forest. And so the rearers are out there in the forest with them. And you can imagine when there's a rain or a hailstorm, the caterpillars are thrown out of their trees. And when a flock of birds comes along and sees these gigantic, big, beautiful green caterpillars, they think they've died and gone to heaven. And the rearers are out there with slingshots and mud balls and bows and arrows trying to keep the predators away. And then there's small predators like wasps that lay their eggs inside the mature caterpillars. And when they hatch, they start eating the silkworms' insides from the inside out, and they die. So there's just so much involved. And that's what took me back and back and back again, just to finally get a true understanding. And that took well over 30 years of going back to the villages to understand the whole process of all these wild silks.
I've noticed differences in how popular wild silks are Did you notice other changes over those 30 years among the people who were rearing the silk?
A huge difference. Because this is mostly happening in India, at least two of them. Tessa is grown in other areas as well, China and Korea and a few other areas. But because most of the wild silk is grown in India, there is a huge influx of money from the government. Because until India got its independence from Britain in 1947, the people were really taken advantage of. Especially the textile people were taken advantage of because Britain wanted that market for themselves. And so they were putting huge tariffs on the Indian cloth. Then when India got its independence, Gandhi said, "We are a country of cloth. Cloth has always seen us through hard times, and cloth is going to help us now that we've got our independence." And so written into the Constitution, there's a Ministry of Textiles. Can you imagine living in a country with a Ministry of Textiles? And under the Ministry of Textiles, there are lots of different branches, the Central Silk Board, the Cotton Association, the Jute Association, and they all receive money from the government to help the indigenous people work with what they've always worked with and give them some support that way. So raising of the wild silk was always done by the Adivasi. That's what they call their indigenous people. It's always been raised by the Adivasi for tens of thousands of years. It's been part of not only their finances, but their spirituality and their cultural traditions. And so they're helping the Adivasi use that to bring themselves out of poverty. So, yeah, it's just been that influx of money that has helped the silk industry change. Now, since 1966, when the Central Silk Board got involved with the raising of wild silk, the income of the farmers or rearers has increased 900%. And since I've been traveling, I can see a lot more increase in their income. And the reason for that is before the Central Silk Board got involved, the rearers had all kinds of superstition revolving around the raising of the silkworms. They thought that when disease hit, that it was actually brought in by evil moths. And the men were traditionally the rearers. And when they went out into the forest, they built a date palm hut and they lived there for the 30 to 35 days during the rearing away from their women. So there were all these superstitions. And the Central Silk Board is a group of scientists and engineers, and they had to work very slowly and very carefully with the traditional rearers so that they could introduce scientific methods, but not take away from the traditional knowledge, because the scientists learned a lot of things from the traditional rearers as well. But the thing that helped them the most as far as them gaining more money and more yarn and therefore more popularity, as we're seeing today, was helping them with disease. And this is something that can be seen or that can be identified by looking at the mother moth after she lays her eggs. And it was in the mid-1800s, sericulture is what raising silkworms is called, like agriculture is raising food. It was in the 1800s, the sericulture industry in Europe was devastated by disease, and they put Louis Pasteur on the problem. And it took him a while, but he figured out that by checking the mother moth's body and looking under a microscope after removing some fluid from her, they could see if she had disease. And if she had disease, then they destroyed her eggs and her, and that really took care of the disease problem. And so therefore, the amount of caterpillars that now survive, and therefore more cocoons, therefore more money, things have really, really moved forward. And it's a much better life for the rearers than it was when I first started traveling there. Boy, that was a long-winded explanation for that.
No, that was great. So somewhere along the line, this turned from being something you were interested in and weaving with silk to something that was a business for you.
Yes.
So can you tell me how Treenway got started?
I can. And if it weren't for Treenway, I wouldn't have been able to do all of this research. And yeah, My husband had already had the business Treenway when we met, but it wasn't really involved much in silk. And this is back in the late 70s, early 80s, when we really didn't have much silk. The only silk that I ever found was from old estate sales. And we started corresponding with Japan and China, and that was back in the days of the blue airmail letters. And then they sent us some samples. And I actually wasn't happy with what they sent us because it was all way too fine for us, especially in the 70s and the 80s when we were working with heavier yarns. So then I sat down at the spinning wheel and I spun some yarns and I sent it back to them. So all of this took months because it went by sea mail. And then they'd send back yarns and I'd go, oh, we need to have the twist a little bit tighter or this or that. And that's how we got started because I was so interested in silk. And our suppliers in China were absolutely fabulous to work with us that way. And even back then, we traveled there to see what the factories were doing and how they operated. That was important to us, the ethical part of it. And they came to visit us as well, which was very interesting because their mindset was very different than what we were, artisans. And it was very interesting. A delegation of five came one time and I took them up to my studio and I wanted to show them what we were doing with their product because not only did we have yarns, we also had fibers. So I sat down at the spinning wheel and showed them, you know, what we were doing and spun some yarn for them. And their eyes were sort of glazed over and they were nodding their heads. And then I sat down at the loom. I had a beautiful warp on and I started weaving and again, sort of glassed over eyes and nodding their heads because these guys, you know, worked in the factories. And one of the guys looked at me and he said, you know, in China, we have automated machines that do this work. And I laughed and it was very interesting because the quietest man, the head man, he then turned all around in the studio 360 degrees and he said, I get it. You're artists, aren't you? And I said, yes, we are. He said, now I understand why you always order such small amounts. Because most of their other people that bought from them were big factories.
Would somebody in a factory like that use the silk noil that you bought from Robin and Russ at the beginning?
It's a great question. They might, but most likely not. So all of those other yarns that we say that they come from the waste part of the cocoons, all those other yarns, they wouldn't use in factories. Now, they might be sent to Europe because Europe did all kinds of interesting things with those yarns, but certainly not China. And I'm sure that they saw some of those fabrics. But again, they were woven on power looms and didn't have the same kind of texture and color mixture and everything else that we did. Because when they came up to the studio, I had garments that I had woven and I had all kinds of samples set out with all the things that we had woven with the yarn that they sent us. And again, you know, it just was beyond some of them. But the one fellow that said, I get it, you're artists, he then started picking everything up and feeling it and said, this is much heavier cloth than we make, but I really like it. So that was interesting and really fun.
That's really cool. Who was using the wild silks that you were finding? So you developed an interest in using it in your work and other weavers' works, but who was using it where it was originally grown?
India. India uses all of the silk that they produce, and they still have to import some silk from China. So India has always used their wild silks. Assam in particular love their muga and they love their iri. In fact, muga is not a high producer. And when I first started traveling there, I knew about muga and I saw muga in one of the government stores and went, oh my gosh, I have got to see this. It is so fantastic. But that was the only muga I saw. And back in those days, in the 80s, it was very precious to the Assamese people. They used it for all rites of passage and everything else. So A lot of it did not leave Assam, much less India. And the same with Erie. Erie has always been women's work. And the women made big, heavy shawls for their men. And they made as many shawls as they could so each man could give his son a shawl. And so a lot of the Muga and Erie stayed in Assam. And the tussa was used all throughout India. Erie is different as well, because not only is it, you know, cotton-like, but it's always been women's work. The women do the raising. The women do the spinning. The women do the weaving. They do all of it. Whereas in tussa and Muga, there's a division of labor between the men and the women, what they do between all of it. In tussa, the men do rearing. The women have started in the last 10 years joining in on the rearing. The men do most of the weaving because they put on really long warps, 125-yard warps, and it's really heavy work weaving. So the men do most of the weaving, and the women do all the winding of the bobbins. Whereas the Erie, the women do all of it. They do everything. It's part of their supplemental income. And as of the last 10 years, it's fast becoming a sole part of income for them, which is just a great thing to see.
So I've noticed that you've talked about reeling and also spinning. Are all of those cocoons reeled, or are some of them pierced and carded and spun?
It's a very good question. For Muga and tussa, they're reeled and spun. And then we'll talk about Erie as a separate entity. So the highest quality yarn is reeled yarn. Silk is comprised of two proteins in the silkworm's body. One is called fibroin, and the second is called sarrasin. And when the silk is extruded from the silkworm's body, those two proteins come in contact with the air, solidify, and become a silk strand. It truly is magic. The protein sarrasin is a sticky gummy substance that makes the silk fibers of fibroin hold together and form the cocoon. So in the industry and in the villages, the highest quality silk is just unraveled from the cocoon. Now, there's about 3/4 of a mile of silk in a cocoon. When a silkworm spins, it's a 3-day marathon. It's nonstop spinning, and it's one strand that's about 3/4 of a mile long. When we reel the silk, we have to soften the cocoons. We have to soften that sarrasin, because you felt a cocoon, you know how hard it is. So we have to use some alkali to soften that sarrasin and then find the running end of the cocoon. And that's not easy either. And then unravel it. So in a factory, as well as in a village situation, one strand of silk or one filament of silk is so fine, you can barely see it with your naked eye unless you hold it to the light just right. So there's anywhere from 8 to 20 to 30 strands unraveled at one time. And when they're unraveled, they're either twisted on a woman's thigh, that's what they do for tussa, or they're twisted on a woman's forearm, and that's what they do for Muga, so that the strands of yarn touch each other again while they're damp, and they solidify and become a much heavier strand of yarn. So that's reeled silk. And as they're making the reeled silk, as the cocoon is unraveling, it takes that caterpillar 3 days to spin. And at the end of that 3-day marathon, the caterpillar is pooping out. The caterpillar itself, a tussar caterpillar, is the diameter of my thumb and about 6 inches long. Well, a cocoon is not that big at all. By the time the caterpillar has finished spinning, it's already starting to lose its caterpillar nest, if there is such a thing, and it's looking all shriveled up. And the inside of the cocoon, the silk that's on the inside of the cocoon, is very weak. And the cocoon breaks, or the strand breaks, when there's a thin silken envelope. So that thin silken envelope is then put on a waste pile. Then there are the cocoons that they've saved for reproduction purposes, so that the moths can break out, mate, lay eggs, and carry on. And so those cocoons where the moths broke out of have made a hole. And of course, it can't be reeled then, unraveled. That gets put on a waste pile. So there's all kinds of other cocoons that haven't been shapen very well, that are not reelable. They're all put on a waste pile. And then that is what makes spun silk, the second quality of silk. And that silk, we have to treat much as we do wool or cotton. We make sure that it's degummed, it gets carded, it gets combed, and then it can be spun on a spinning machine. And the third quality, the noil, after it's been carded and combed, there's still a short little bits that are stuck to the carding machine. Let's put it that way. That is spun and made into the third quality of silk, noil silk. Erie, my central silkboard friend Surat says that the Erie silkworm is a lazy fellow because they spin what's called an open-ended cocoon. They spin a while and stop. They spin a while and stop. They spin a while and stop. And so there's a hole in the end of the cocoon. Those Erie cocoons cannot be reeled. They can only be spun. And remember I said that Erie is the women's work. And the women do most of the spinning of the Erie on a tockley, a drop spindle tockley. The central silkboard is providing them with spinning wheels, but they still prefer the tockley because they can pick it up for 10 minutes or 15 minutes in between other chores. And the other thing that's really interesting to know about Erie is that the women make more money from the pupa than they do from the cocoon shell. The pupa is removed through that hole. It's easy for them to put their finger in and remove it. And it's sold as food for people as well as animals. Now, the other thing that's very interesting is people also tout Erie silk as peace silk. And so vendors, merchants, people in the know haven't really connected all of those dots for the consumer, because Erie does not have all these happy little butterflies flying around at all. The women have taken the pupa out for food. The other thing that I'd like to note is that I talk about the life cycle of the silkworm being 30 to 35 days, growing from a little egg to the size of my thumb, 6 inches long, et cetera, et cetera. And in the moth stage, the butterfly stage, their sole purpose is to mate and lay eggs, and they die within 5 to 7 days. The inside of their body is filled with reproductive organs only. There's no eating apparatus, no digestive system. So after 5 to 7 days, they die naturally because they haven't eaten or drunk anything. They've just done their job of reproducing.
So their jobs are eat, spin, reproduce, and that's the whole job.
That's the whole job. Wow. Yeah.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you about that because I do see peace silk and ahimsa and even somewhat in Indian craft textile stores where they talk about, oh, it's peace silk.
I know. You just have to be wary. There is some real peace silk. But if you think about it, whoever buys the peace silk would have to pay the rears for not only the cocoon shell. They would have to pay them the same amount of money that they would be making from the pupa as well. And most women make 60% of their money from the pupa and 40% of their money from the cocoon shell. So again, it's just one of those gray areas that I think people don't connect all the dots.
Yeah, that's true. Also, if they just all reproduced and continued to reproduce, there would be an awful lot of them.
Well, there would be.
It would be great to have more silk and silkworms, but they would quickly eat all of the food.
That's absolutely right. There wouldn't be enough food for them. There wouldn't be enough care. And so they wouldn't have a very happy life at all.
So somewhere along the line, in addition to developing yarns for weavers and artists, Trinwe also became known for their colors and for dyeing. How did that come about?
Well, every weaver just loves color. And the yarn that we started getting, first of all, was white. And at that time, back in the 70s and the 80s, if we wanted color from China, it was horrible. It was awful pink and it was awful green and it was awful blue. I mean, I just ordered color samples once and that was that. And so then we trained, we had our friend Michelle Whiplinger come and train some of the people in our vicinity to dye. And then we made our own color palette. For years, we kept adding colors and I would work with the dyers and say, no, it needs to have a little bit more blue, or, oh, that should have a little bit more yellow. And then as time went on and we got more and more dyers, then we could develop colorways that had variegations in them for embroiderers. And that's totally different variegations, or sizes of variegations, I should say, than for spinners. Because when you're embroidering, it doesn't take much of one color before you want the color to change. Whereas in spinning, you can have the colors as much as 6 to 8 inches apart. Whereas in embroidery, you want the colors to change within an inch or an inch and a half. So it just was so much fun developing all the colorways and working with all of our dyers. And all I can say is that I could have, you know, my husband and I could have never, ever dreamed of making a better business for ourselves. And once you get started, things evolve and you think of more things and you add more things. And because I am a spinner and a weaver, I knew exactly what would excite other people as well. And then education was always really, really important to us. And so we educated a lot about silk and the different qualities of silk. And weavers knew they could phone and say, well, I want to do this, but I'm not sure where to start. And so we could talk them through what weight to use and how to set it and all those things. So that part of life, the business part of life, I would have never thought could be so much fun, but it was fabulous. And, you know, traveling to the conferences, meeting all of our customers, that was great. Then I was on the road teaching a lot and met a lot of customers and wonderful workshop participants that way. So it was just fabulous.
What subjects did you teach?
I taught silk clothing, and what kinds of structures and how differently we had to think about set for silk than we do other things. Again, because it's a slippery fiber, we have to set it a bit differently than you would wool. Because when I first started weaving, we had very heavy wool fiber and we were making ponchos and bock jackets and we were setting that really heavy fiber at about 8 ends per inch and we couldn't get our arms for our bock jackets down. And we learned over time that you had to set your wool further and further apart and you could wash it and full it and have a beautiful cloth. Whereas silk is the opposite. You know, you would have to set it, you know, maybe 6, 8, 10 threads per inch more than you would for cotton or something else because it is slippery. So I talked about clothing in regards to that. And I also taught a workshop about color in silk, or not color in silk, but color in weaving. Because as weavers, we have to think about color very differently. We don't put on a yellow warp and cross it with a blue weft and get a green fabric. You know, it's a totally different thing. And we have to think about proportion and what's going to be our spark and everything else. So I taught about different structures, weave structures, and how to introduce color to the weave structures. And then I also taught silk fusion as well, taking silk fiber and turning it into a cloth. Some people call it silk paper. So I taught all of those different workshops and had a great time meeting people, well, all over the world, like, because I taught in Australia and New Zealand and the Netherlands and the Philippines and all kinds of wonderful places.
Silk is a really fun subject to talk about color and to look at dyeing because it takes color so deeply.
Absolutely. And then there's also the sheen factor as well, because that can really change the way a color interacts with another color. And it shows either more deeply or lighter, depending on how the light hits it. So yeah, it is really fun because it does really suck in the color and show itself back to us as well.
Now, Michelle was really known for her natural dyeing. Is that what she taught your folks to do?
Well, before natural dyeing, she was working with Lanisette dyes. And so when we started, we were working with Lanisette dyes. And then over the years, we kept talking about changing to natural dyes, but we had so many colors on our color palette. It just seemed daunting. And so we were going to start a natural dye, just a small natural dye section, which we were about to do when we sold the business. And now Susan is doing that. So I'm thrilled that she's got a set of natural dyes as well.
So Trinway, I went from Canada down to near where I am in Colorado, but the two of you have maintained a pretty close relationship. How is it to be a consultant on a business that you developed yourself?
It's wonderful. When we sold the business, we actually got to choose who we were going to sell to. We did it all the wrong way, according to accountants and everybody else. We advertised it in our newsletter. We put up the price, and we had about 15 interested people. And in the end, we got to choose. I talked to people on the phone first. There were a lot of people that actually came, but I talked to people on the phone first. And there was one woman that I talked to, and she said, "Oh, I know I would love this business. I've always wanted a business where I could sit and spin all day long." And I checked her off the list right away. I thought, "Oh my goodness, isn't that a dream?" And people came, we asked people to come so they could actually see what was involved in the business. And Susan really got it, and we really clicked. And so it's just wonderful to pass on what we started and all the different things that we did to someone so capable and interested in carrying things on. So it's fun. It's just fun to do that. Keep it rolling right along.
I'm interested in that because there are so many yarn businesses and yarn fiber spinning and weaving businesses that either close or move on to a next generation. And so how does that happen? So I'm really interested in how that's worked for you.
Really great, because our next generation wasn't interested. You know, our kids weren't interested in the business at all. And so it's just really nice that someone did want to carry on the business, because it would have been very sad if there wasn't anybody capable and interested and good at what they did, just to see it wither away and die after all the exciting, wonderful work to put it together.
And speaking of exciting, wonderful work, you have been working on a book.
Yes. The book is called In Search of Wild Silk, Indigenous People Growing Their Heritage. And as I said, I've been traveling to India for well over 30 years. And Michelle and I, when we first started traveling, we met a woman called Malati, who is a travel agent. And this is back in the days before the internet. So when we set our first trip, someone introduced us to her, and we went to her office, and her desk was piled high with airplane schedules and bus schedules and train schedules. And you could barely see her, this short little 5-foot woman who really packs a punch. And she said, "Well, leave your passports with me, and you'll come to our house tonight." Oh, yeah, we did that in those days. "You'll come to my house tonight, and I'll have everything ready for you." And we thought, how? Because it was, I think we were, that first time we were there for 5 weeks. And we went from Kashmir way in the north to Madras way in the south, and over to Assam in the east and Rajasthan. And that, we went all over the country. And she had pulled that off in less than 24 hours. It was absolutely amazing. And Malati, after that first trip that we were there, we were the girls that she never had. She had two boys. And before we left that first night, when we went to pick up the tickets, we went in her bedroom and we sat on the bed and told her exactly what we were going to do and what we were interested in. Not just that we wanted to go to these places and look at temples. And she was very interested, because she was totally passionate about her country and her people. And we sat on the bed, and she opened her closet, because we were interested in cloth. She wanted to show us her 365 saris, one for every day of the year. And Michelle and I noticed there were lots of polyester in that mix. And she was too new of a friend to say, "Malati, a woman of your stature needs to get rid of the polyester." We just let that one go. So we had a wonderful evening, and she said, and as soon as you get back, you must come and tell me everything, which we did. We went and we had another all-nighter sitting on her bed. Malati was crying tears of joy and compassion for all the things that we'd seen and the people that we told her about and what they were doing and the poor conditions that they lived in, even though they were so skilled and such intelligent people. And she said, well, you'll come back and you'll lead a tour of textile artists. And we said, Malati, that's not what we do. We will certainly give slide lectures and talk to people about your country and tell people about the amazing artisans, but we don't lead tours. And by the end of the evening, we had struck a deal. If Malati got rid of her polyester saris within a year, we would bring a group of textile artists back to go on a tour. So that's a long way of introducing you to Malati, who said to me year after year after year, Karen, it is your duty to tell the rest of the world about the people who raise wild silk and what wild silk is about. And so after retirement, I thought I would write the book right away, and I didn't, because I did a lot of writing and research and everything in the business. I just needed some time to chill, but that little voice was always in the back of my head. It's your duty. Oh my goodness, those are heavy duty words. So finally, I fulfilled my duty and sat down for 2.5 years and wrote the book and pulled the photos together and everything else. And it has been, it's been an amazing journey. I would have never thought it had taken so long. And, you know, you hear authors say things like, well, the book just took its own turn. And I thought to myself, being a weaver, you know, we plan, everything is laid out in a grid form. And I sort of would roll my eyes and think, well, how can anyone say that? Well, it's true. The book did take its own turns. And that happens when you start writing, because we've been talking about, you know, the things about 30 to 35 days and the rearers have to be out there with their caterpillars. And, you know, all of that is fascinating and it's really interesting. But more than that is definitely what happens in the families and what happens in the villages. And so when I started writing, I changed all kinds of things about the book. And the book now has a lot of journal entries. Every chapter has at least one or two or three journal entries. And the journal entry is entering a village and talking to a rearer and exactly what they have to say. The journal entry may be a time that we were stuck in Darjeeling during a strike and we had to get out of the town at 3 o'clock in the morning so no one would hear us and we could just roll the car down the hill. So, you know, it's filled with all the personal things that happen when you're in search of something for over 30 years. So it's been lots of fun and it'll be great to see the book finally on the shelves.
Now, Malati was not the person who introduced you to your first silk rearer, was she? How did you find those folks?
Oh, let me think. Oh, I know. Oh, my goodness. We were so brazen. I mean, we were really naive. We had no idea. We were two, you know, middle-class white women going to this country, just flying by the seat of our pants. And we heard that when we went into this government store, it was an interesting government store. They had what they called then Central Cottage Industries. And they had a buyer. And this buyer would travel to small villages all throughout the country and gather beautiful artisan things, whether it be brass or wood or embroidery or puppets or cloth or whatever. And that's where we actually learned a lot about where we had to go, at least what state we had to go to see what we wanted to see. And we talked to the woman who is the buyer there and told her what we wanted to do. And she said, oh, well, I can set you up with some villages to see some cloth. And we went, oh, that would be fabulous. And then she said, well, and if you're going to Bangalore, that's where the Central Silk Board is situated. Maybe you should talk to some of those fellows and see if they can help you. So when we did get to Bangalore, we just walked into the head guy's office of the whole Central Silk Board, introduced ourselves, told him what we wanted to learn, and he was lovely. He set us up. And again, India didn't even have very many telephones. They didn't have an infrastructure for it. They didn't have phone lines. So everything was done by telex back then. And so he said, well, I'm going to send out some telexes to some of my outposts where the rearers are working in the forest. And I'll have some of those fellows meet you and take you out to meet the rearers. So I'd actually forgotten that. So we just walked into this head guy's office and he was lovely. That would never happen today, but it did then. So that was great.
Rats, I was going to try it. My husband is from Bangalore.
Ah!
And when we go, you know, Bangalore is a big city. It's kind of like San Jose. So we do go to the Central Cottage Industries, but I have not yet marched into the Silk Board. I'll have to try that next time.
You will have to try that. The Central Silk Board has been, they have been so generous and so patient. They've been generous because they have given us guides. They've offered us places to stay in their guest house. Not only guides, when we go to a village, then we have to get another person as well to speak the local dialect. So, you know, we're going from English to Hindi to a local dialect and back again. So they've been very generous, not only with their time and guides, but oh my gosh, my incessant questions. You know, I get home at night and I write all these questions in my journal. I read what we had done during the day and I went, oh, I forgot to ask that. Oh, I didn't understand that. So then we get in the car the next morning and, you know, these guys are so patient and they answer all the questions that, you know, came up after a day out in the field.
So in your working retirement, a lot of people think about when they retire, they can't wait to spin and weave. You have had spinning and weaving as your business. Are you still doing it for fun?
I'm not doing much weaving at all anymore. I've taken a totally different turn. I'm working a lot with Silk Fusion, and it's taken me months and months, but I figured out how I can print some of my photographs on the Fusion. And then I enhance it with stitching and quilting. And I've been doing a lot of botanical printing. And I've gone full circle. My grandma taught me how to stitch when I was 4 years old. So I'm doing a lot of stitching again. And I'm stitching on the botanical prints. So I haven't woven anything in about 5 years, which is so interesting. I've gone from this very structured life of running a business and being totally organized to be out on the road of teaching at the same time and going to conferences and all this kind of stuff to totally winging it in my artwork. You know, botanical printing, it's so interesting. I absolutely adore it. And I have sample after sample after sample. And I think, okay, I know what's going to happen with this sleeve. And I know what's going to happen with this amount of iron I'm using, et cetera, et cetera. And then I unwrap it and it looks totally different. So every time I wrap something up to put in the steamer, I say to the bundle, I'm grateful for whatever you give me because it certainly won't be what I'm expecting. And I think it's such a very good thing for me after having such a structured life to be able to just do something and say, I accept whatever you give me.
So off the grid, off the plan, but still silk.
Absolutely still silk. Yeah, all silk. It's part of my DNA now.
Silkworm.
Yeah.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed speaking with you and I can't wait to read your book.
Oh, thank you, Anne. It's been such a pleasure to meet you and to chat with you this afternoon.
Karen wrote about her travels with Michelle Wiplinger, the founder of Earth Hues, in our book, The Long Thread. Listeners to the podcast can receive a free copy of the ebook for The Long Thread when they purchase a copy of the print book. Just leave podcast in the notes when you purchase the book at shop.longthreadmedia.com. Thanks to Treadway Silks for sponsoring this episode. Thank you for listening to The Long Thread podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate the show and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again.